Final Reckonings. It's a dull truism that politics makes good people do bad things. The truth is that it works far better when we get bad people doing good things. The Master. With Buckingham Palace effectively sold off, the King had transferred some of his official duties to St. James's Palace. Even for him, Windsor was sometimes inconvenient. So it was in the gloomy red staterooms there that Caroline Phillips, fresh from her triumph at Stoke, was invited to kiss hands. The ancient ceremony never actually happened. The King was too interested in having a conversation with his new Prime Minister. He'd been impressed with her policies towards business and the environment, particularly after Ulwin Grimaldi, who he couldn't stand. He liked the idea of being the first monarch ever to have a lesbian leading his government. Let them call him an old fogey after that. On the other hand, there was a certain steeliness about her that he felt uneasy with. That was the thing about democracy. One always had to deal with people one didn't really know. It being mid-afternoon, he had ordered a light repast of organic ginger biscuits, hand-woven on his own estate. Honey cakes made with the honey of a rare, almost extinct bee, and a bottle of English hock, produced on the sunlit uplands of Wiltshire. Caroline arrived on time, curtsied low, and took a biscuit. She did rather light up the room, the King felt.
"Well, congratulations, Mrs. Phillips. You seem to have won almost all of our filthy press round your side. May I ask, do you think you can form a stable administration?"
"Your Royal Highness, thank you. Yes, we should have a pretty secure majority for at least a year or two. The Cabinet is, between us, sir, too tired and too divided to cause any problems, and the greybeards of the party are behind me, so I think we'll cope."
"Without the need for a general election. That is excellent news. We'll get the ceremonial business over in a jiffy, but I really want to talk to you about your plans for the country. Are you determined to return us to the bosom of Brussels?"
"Sir, I am, but it won't happen for many years. It will take endless negotiations and the consumption of copious quantities of humble pie with grovel sauce to get us there. Of course, that's what politicians are for, sir, isn't it? In the meantime, the priority is to repair our relations with the United States. We can get capital from China, but we need American know-how, freer access to their markets and so on, just to keep our chin above the water. We need to come to some new agreements pretty quickly."
"So everybody keeps telling me. The ambassador, your old mentor, his friends—"
"Sir, it is absolutely not true that the master was any kind of guide or mentor to me. The man is frankly a liability, and to you too, sir. But he's probably right about that."
"Nothing comes from nothing, Prime Minister. What do the Americans want? What do we bring to the table?"
"The security stuff, obviously. The Guardian will make a stink and there'll be trouble from a few crusty old military types in the Lords, but we'll get it through without too much difficulty. They want access to the NHS. And they'd like some tough action against the BBC, to make it easier for their media companies to make a bit of decent money over here."
"To be frank, Prime Minister, to be very frank, I'm not at all keen on the sound of this. The BBC can be a pain in the neck, but at least it's our pain in our neck. And wholesale privatization of the National Health Service would, I promise you, destroy both your party and your premiership."
Caroline flushed and put down her glass of wine, which was anyway warm and sickly. She was about to interrupt when the King abruptly stood up, jammed his hands into his pockets, walked towards a window, and then turned around.
"I remind you, Prime Minister, of my rights, to be consulted, to be sure, and also to encourage where that is warranted. But also to warn. You must not take this ill, but many of your predecessors have flinched from facing difficult choices of this kind. both in his very room and before that across the park.
Sir, I understand, but I assure you that I will move cautiously. The BBC has become a problem for all the rest of the media. I propose to throttle it very gently and very slowly, but to death. As for the NHS, again, we will move very gently. Pilot schemes, efficiency programmes, new rules on tendering. Very few of your subjects, with respect, will concentrate on any of that for very long. King Charles grunted. He had an excellent grunt. He'd been working on it for years.
My family has, of course, had its ups and downs with the Americans. For more than a century, however, we have regarded them as our most reliable and trustworthy friends. But, Prime Minister, there's a big difference between that and being, as it were, a wholly owned subsidiary.
If that were even a remote possibility, sir, I wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation. I promise you that I intend to be my own woman. But even as her own woman, Caro would need help. After the palace, she called Peter Quint. He had been as obliging in his article as he'd suggested, but she did not offer him an interview. She offered him the post of Prime Minister's press secretary. Quint, who had been a little less self-important since his interview with Angela, accepted. Later that day, giving her first round of interviews as Prime Minister, Caro got Peter to have a word in the ear of the BBC's political editor. It would be of mutual benefit, suggested Quint, if he asked her about the master. Good story. So he did, of course. On air, Caroline replied that the master had done great service to his country, long in the past, and that he retained the affection of many of the British people. But he had no influence over the current Labour Party, and he would have none over her or her government. Let me make it quite plain. There will be no private meetings with or behind the stairs influence from that source. We will do everything above board. He had elements of greatness, but he has squandered too many years consorting with wealthy private individuals and serving the interests of overseas companies. He is a spent force, who is no longer actively involved in the political life of this country, and he himself is very well aware of that fact. It was brutal. Even on this day of all days, it led the news. The master had had a superb new state-of-the-art running machine installed in the country house he'd brought north of London. It wasn't checkers, but it wasn't too shabby. It had a tower, Victorian battlements, and a tennis court. He had added a cinema, a heated indoor pool, and cottages in the grounds for his grandchildren. There was no library. He wasn't big on books. The gym was his special pride, gleaming with oiled and sparkling equipment. The running machine came not only with multiple speeds and elevations and a screen showing great runs of the world, through forests, along mountain tracks and down the miraculously emptied streets of famous cities, but it also had an on-board coach, whose disembodied voice crackled out of speakers. The master was close to his record time for a 10K, just leaving San Francisco under the Golden Gate Bridge, with sparkling turquoise water to one side of him and the shadows of redwoods to the other. He was gasping.
"Way to go! Keep those thighs pumping," said the coach's recorded voice.
The master accelerated.
"Yeah! Good job! Who's the man?"
Coach wanted to know.
"I'm the man," puffed the master.
"Damn right! Don't quit on me now," said the coach.
Said the master.
"Who's the man?"
"I'm the man."
But then, without warning, half a kilometre before the finishing line, which featured a row of graphically enhanced women jumping up and down, whooping and calling his name, the master found himself slowing down. The machine was rapidly decelerating. Coach was furious.
"Don't quit on me now! Don't you dare give up now! You a man or you a chicken?"
The master was too exhausted to give a coherent reply, though he felt suitably rebuked. But it wasn't his fault. His wife was standing behind him, having turned the machine off.
"Sadie, I was about to beat my record. Didn't you hear, coach?"
he panted.
"You really are overdoing it. Those aren't buttocks anymore, they're a pair of gooseberries.
I'm here on more serious business, however.
Have you seen the news? Have you heard what that ghastly Phillips woman has been saying about you?"
He hadn't. As he vigorously rubbed himself down, Sadie filled him in, omitting no hurtful detail. He clicked onto News 24, and there it all was. The commentators had taken the new Prime Minister's words as signalling that it was open season on him, and they were all piling in. All those half-forgotten scandals, all those decomposing disappointments freshly stirred up. The pouchy faces of his disgruntled enemies were being interviewed again and again in a never-ending purgatorial loop of denunciation. It was Dante. It was foul.
"It's foul," said Sadie.
The master turned and looked her full in the face.
"No, it's not. It's hurtful, yes. She's going to be a monster. But as soon as she threw her vicar to the wolves, I knew that one day she would deny me too. And in a way, it's really rather wonderful."
"Wonderful?" spat Sadie.
"She's a cold-hearted bitch. Caroline Phillips is a bad woman."
"Exactly. Bad people doing good things. She's just what this country needs.
Of all of them, you see, my dear, she was the only one who really listened."